Blog Talk Radio.
And I wish everybody a happy, successful, healthy, and prosperous new year. I'm going to give you music, and I hope to give you more music than talk. I'm listening to Mike Savage. It's his first show of the new time slot on WABC. It started at 3 o'clock, and I'm not impressed. I used to be a big fan. I thought he was great, patriotic. But today he talks out of both sides of his mouth. And he has a vendetta against Hannity, Rush Limbaugh, Greta Van Susteren, everybody at Fox. And that's not the way to bring a country together. The theme of the Spirit of America Party is unity, from sea to shining sea. And those who divide us will destroy us. So, get out my olive branch and let the doves fly. However, we have a communist contingent in this country known as the Democrat Party, and it has to be destroyed. If we do not destroy it, it will destroy us. They have turned our world upside down. And the last time I heard that tune, the British was surrendering at Yorktown. And that was the tune that they played when they surrendered to George Washington. So, with the help of the French, by the way. So, having said that, I'm going to give you some quotations from Americans. And I'm going to give you a little Brazilian music. I found some nice Brazilian music. And it goes to show you, one good deed deserves a good tune. A nurse that I know was taking care of a Latin American lady in a nursing home, and the Latin American lady happened to have a son in the entertainment business in Latin America, and she gave this nurse a CD. And the music on the CD was fantastic. It's like, you know, it's like the truth. The truth is being hidden by the New York Times and Newsweek, the entire media, NBC, nothing but communists. And when you get a taste of real truth, you know, it's like a refreshing a drink of water. And it's the same thing with music that's not being allowed to be played in the United States because it's too good and it would wipe out the crap that we got. So I'm going to give you a little treat. And when I come back, I'll read you some clips from different books that I've been taking a look at and see if we can illuminate the 20 of 14. So I'm looking for Brazilian music. Here we go. 3 minutes of it. The Brazilian language has a different, it's more rhythmic than Spanish. I think so anyway. But anyway, we're going to review a book called Throw Them All Out by Peter Schweitzer, How Politicians and Their Friends Get Rich Off Insider Stock Tips, Land Deals, and Cronyism That Would Send the Rest of Us to Prison. The book Washington Does Not Want You to Read, Throw Them All Out. How is it that politicians often enter office with relatively modest assets, but then, as investors, regularly beat the stock market and sometimes beat the most rapacious hedge funds? How did some members of Congress know to dump their stock holdings just in time to escape the effects of the 2008 financial meltdown? And how is it that billionaires and hedge fund managers often make well-timed investment decisions that anticipate events in Washington? In this powerfully argued book, Peter Schweitzer blows the lid off Washington's epidemic of honest graft. There's no such thing. A crook is a crook. He exposed a secret world where members of Congress insert earmarks into bills to improve their own real estate holdings, and campaign contributors receive billions in federal grants. Nobody goes to jail. Throw them all out. We've got enough money that we could give a tax refunds and reduce taxes to every American. We are filthy rich, and our problem is a political system that outspends what they suck in, and they have no brakes. Throw them all out, cast light into the darkest corners of the political system, and offers ways to clean house. Okay, so that's the story on Throw Them All Out, and then here's Chapter 1. And what do you think Chapter 1 is? The drug trade. We were having a New Year's Eve dinner, and the subject came up about legalizing marijuana. And I just happened to mention that everybody who ever wrote deeds started with weed. And, whoa, boy, the table lit up. Yeah, well, what about alcohol? That's one of the arguments that they use. What about alcohol? Let me tell you, there are guys sitting in bars right now that have been there for 90 years. They got a nice tan, and they're living on a quarter of a liver. But they outlast all of the junkies who OD'd. And you go to the cemeteries and you look at some of the ages on the gravestones. They didn't die from the plague. And a 22-year-old comes to mind. He was a marijuana a trainee, and he took one hit of heroin, and now he's pushing up daisies. He was gone from this earth, protected by a mother who loved him, for at least 18 years of his life. 4 years later, on his own, smoking weed, he took one hit of heroin and he's gone. You know what the recovery rate from heroin is? The rehab rate? Less than 1%. You think about that. Okay, so here's the drug trade. And by the way, you know, you don't have to smoke marijuana if you want to do weed. You want to get the effects of marijuana. You don't have to smoke it. You don't have to suck it into your lungs and put your hand over your mouth and keep it there for as long as you can and let all those tars and pesticides find little homes in your air sacs. You don't have to do that. You can take what's called Marinol, and it's in a pill form. And it was originally for sick people, and marijuana does help sick people, nauseous people. But some people can't even swallow the pill. They're so nauseous. So they also have it in suppository form. And that's what should be the law of the land. You can't smoke it. And you can't take it in pill form. You can only take it in suppository form. And when it's legal throughout the country, I'm going to open up a chain of suppository stores. And we'll call the brand Stick It To Me. Yeah. Or Shove This. Huh? The drug trade. Over the past half century, there has been a massive web woven between the federal government and the healthcare system. Conclusion, from listening to what people are paying for very expensive drugs, the drug company is sitting in the king's seat, and they have made a deal with the Obama administration that they'll be allowed to pirate the people. And I also believe that insurance companies have made a deal with the Obama administration that they'll be allowed to pirate the people. So what you really have in effect is a fifth layer of bloodsuckers who are, is now the federal government. The federal government's coming in for a piece of the action. And the tax in Colorado on dopers, 25% on weed. And they've already done $70 million on the rise in junkies. Oh, you can't call us a junkie. We can give this up anytime you want. Oh, yeah? How'd you do with cigarettes? I can't give up cigarettes. Yeah, how'd you do with your weight? No, I can't lose any weight. Yeah. But an opiate, you're gonna be able to whack, huh? Weed whackers. So this is the different drug trade. Oh, so I just started to tell you about this. By 2007, federal government programs like Medicare, Medicaid, and others accounted for 46% of all health care spending in the USA. Knowing that what changes might be in store for those programs and having advance notice of details of other health care legislation could translate into a lot of profits. For a sitting United States Senator trading stocks at the same time you are pushing and writing legislation could net you millions in capital gains. And you should know that they can do insider trading. They can play tips. They passed a law that excluded themselves from being charged as a criminal. And when the public found out that they were exempt from insider trading penalties, they raised hell. So you know what they did? They rescinded the law. They waited 30 days. When the public forgot, they reinstated the law. How's that? Throughout 2009, Washington was consumed by the Patient Protection and Affordable Care Act, which what became commonly known as Obamacare. It began as a campaign promise, became a debate, and ended with horse trading, political threats, and partisan muscle. The bill that was eventually passed, yeah, sign it, and then we'll find out what's in it, said Nancy Pelosi. I just bought a house from her, and I gave her the money, and now I can go see what's in it. The bill that was eventually passed by Congress and signed by President Obama was 2,500 pages long. Very few members actually knew everything that was in the bill or what it all meant. Some members had not even had a chance to read it, probably most. The healthcare industry and pharmaceutical companies employed thousands of lobbyists. Your vote doesn't count as long as there are lobbyists in Washington. Your vote was canceled a long time ago. Until you get rid of all the lobbyists in Washington, your vote doesn't count. The healthcare industry and pharmaceutical companies employed thousands of lobbyists to shape the legislation. When the dust finally settled, clear winners and losers emerged. The details that determined who came out ahead and who didn't were almost always hammered out behind closed doors. A single event could cause the price of a stock to swing wildly. For example, when six senators announced on July the 27th of 2009 that they were going to eliminate the public option, a government-run insurance policy, for their version of the health care reform bill, the share prices of three major insurance companies surged by between 8 and 10% the next day. Trading stocks in such an environment could be highly profitable, especially if you knew about such events in advance. One of those at the center of shaping the bill, listen to this now, was Senator John Kerry of Massachusetts. Kerry, first elected to the Senate in 1984, had been a long time a communist supporter, I put that in there, advocate of health care reform. He serves as a member of the Health Subcommittee on a powerful Senate Finance Committee. the former Democratic nominee for president, reporting for duty, I can betray everybody, is a member of the wealthy Forbes family and is the beneficiary of at least four inherited trusts. In 1995, his wealth jumped dramatically when he married Teresa Hines, the widow of Pennsylvania Senator John Hines, heir to the Hines family fortune. Teresa Hines Kerry is worth hundreds of millions of dollars. Like other very wealthy people, John Kerry is an investor. His family trusts are relatively small, worth less than $1 million, according to his 2009 financial disclosures. By themselves, they could hardly sustain his lifestyle. The bulk of the Kerry's wealth resides in a series of marital trust and commingled fund accounts. Altogether, these funds include significant investments in stocks of many corporations. It is his buying and selling of healthcare stocks during the debate over healthcare reform that is particularly interesting. While some have reported that the Kerry's assets are in a blind trust, they have not been designated as such on his financial disclosure forms. Contrary to public perception, the major pharmaceutical companies were in favor of Obama's health care bill. So what does that tell you? The president's new program was expected to increase the demand for prescription drugs by making health care more accessible. Big Pharma, as the companies are collectively known, decided it could not stop the bill, so it might as well try to influence its provisions. Back in 1994, when the bribe-taking, I put that in there, Clinton administration, and notably the Bee of Benghazi, doesn't have a blood clot, Hillary Clinton, had pushed for dramatic changes in the healthcare system. Several effective ads sponsored by the pharmaceutical industry starring Harry and Louise helped defeat Hillary Care. In 2009, Big Pharma hired the two actors again, only this time they were 15 years older and they were in favor of the bill. How's that? Well, it looks like we finally get health care reform, said Harry in one ad. In July 2009, individual representatives met with key members of Congress and hashed out critical details. As the bill snaked its way through the House and the Senate, where Kerry was actively pushing it, the Kerrys began, here's where the plot thickens, buying stock in the drug maker Teva Pharmaceuticals, T-E-V-A. As the prospects of its passage improved, in November alone, they bought close to $750,000 in the company. When the Kerrys first began buying shares, the stock was trading around $50. After health care reform passed, it surged to $62. In 2010, after the reform bill was signed, the Kerrys sold some of their shares in Teva, reaping tens of thousands in capital gains. It's unclear exactly how much because of the way the transactions are reported. Politicians are required to report ranges only, not exact dollar amounts, and they held on to more than $1 million worth of Teva shares. All in all, healthcare stocks proved to be some of Kerry's best investments that year in terms of return on investment. And to be sure, Senator Kerry wasn't the only congressional trader in pharmaceuticals. John Tanner of Tennessee, a member of the House Ways and Means Committee, bought up to $90,000 worth back in April 2009 when the stock was approving reserve fund budgeting for health care. Also buying Teva was Senator Jim Webb of Virginia. This guy's a rat. And Congressman Vern Buchanan of Florida. Unlike Kerry and Webb, however, Buchanan voted against the bill. Casting a vote is one thing. Betting on the final tally is something else. Most members, most of the time, knew full well which bills will pass before they cast their votes. Health care was an important bill, and the Democrats had such a strong majority. Even if Scott Brown's surprise election in Massachusetts denied them a supermajority of 60 votes in the Senate, then opposing members like Vern Buchanan could still place bets that the bill would eventually get to Obama's desk. I don't trust Scott Brown. He's a Democrat, making believe he's a Republican. The very idea that politicians trade stocks while they are considering major bills comes as a shock to many people. But it's standard behavior in Washington. Senator Tom Carper of Delaware, he's a flag burner along with John Kerry, on the Senate Finance Committee's Health Subcommittee, Carper, more of a centrist than Kerry, was concerned about the public opinion. And according to Tom Daschle, he's another flag burner, who was a point man in the Obama administration, he pushed to pass the bill. Carper was intimately involved in hammering together the health care bill throughout the spring. This is what these guys are doing. They are not serving the people. They're serving themselves. By the fall, he joined a group known as the Gang of Ten, who were trying to bring about a compromise with Republicans. Just a few weeks after three committees had improved health care bills in rapid succession, Carper began buying health care stocks that would benefit from the legislation he was supporting. He bought up to $50,000 in Nationwide Health Properties, a real estate investment trust that specialized in health care, relative related properties. He also picked up shares in Cardinal Health and Care Fusion. As we will see, Cardinal was a popular investment choice for those involved in the healthcare debate. Congressman Melissa Bean of Illinois, a moderate, seemed torn over whether to vote for or against Obamacare. But her indecision didn't apply to her stock portfolio. Along with her husband, Bean traded shares as she watched the debate unfold in Washington. Indeed, although Bean and her husband are active traders, the only stock purchases they made in 2009 were in health care. They bought shares in Cardinal Health, Care Fusion, and two drug manufacturers, Mylan and Teva. Bean bought Teva in April at $46 a share after Obamacare passed. The shares went to $63. She bought Mylan when it traded at $14 a share. After Obamacare became law, it went to $23 a share, up more than 50%. One of the more creative and cynical plays on health care reform came from Congressman Jared Polis of Colorado. Polis is a young politician who has taken his congressional seat in January 2009. He's seen as a rising star with an appointment to the powerful House Rules Committee. He also sits on the House Democratic Steering and Policy Committee and on the Education and Labor Committee's Subcommittee on Healthy Families and Communities. Polis is wealthy. He grew up among privilege, and his family became enormously rich after founding and later selling BlueMountain.com, the greeting card website. So you can see what's going on, and the Kerrys really went to town. Yeah. Meanwhile, John and Teresa Hines Kerry continued to trade along with Teva during 2009. They picked up shares in ResMed, at least $200,000 worth. ResMed makes medical devices such as airway aids for sufferers of sleep apnea. The Kerrys managed to snatch up shares in the $20 to $25 range after health care reform passed. Shares in the company surged to $34, as much as 71% higher than what the Kerrys paid for them. 2 years later, in the spring of 2011, ResMed's stock price had fallen below $30. ResMed was a winner in the healthcare reform legislation, as Reuters declared, thanks in part to John Kerry's efforts. In early versions of the healthcare bill, device makers like ResMed were to be taxed starting in 2010 through an industry fee. In the final bill, fees for medical device makers was delayed until 2013. And the industry tax was replaced by a smaller sales tax, 2.3%. Kerry was a strong opponent of higher taxes on medical device makers. The Kerrys also bought $250,000 and $500,000 between in Thermo Fisher Scientific, which provides products and services to hospitals and medical center. They bought that around $35 a share, and after the reform bill became law, the stock went to $50 a share. While the Kerrys were buying Obamacare winners, they were dumping losers. In the final bill, pharma was a winner. The health insurance industry was a big loser. Not coincidentally, the Kerrys have been selling all their stock in health insurance companies. One such company, United Health, offers Medicare insurance. The legislation dictated lower reimbursements for Medicare procedures, lifetime coverage limits, and protection against pre-existing medical conditions were removed. Extremely popular aspects to the bill, to be sure. But they squeezed United Health's bottom line. By the end of June 2009, the Kerrys had sold all their shares in United Health. And they also dropped their investment in WellPoint, another health benefits company. 6 weeks later, Kerry introduced an amendment to tax generous health care plans, which clearly would hurt the companies like those whose stock he had just sold. So, you can see, these guys are bad news. I'm going to turn to a tune, give you a break.
Um bocado pra te devorar, como um brigadeiro pra te lambuzar. Põe a mão no bolo pra comemorar, dança o meio-dia pra te conquistar. O violeiro toca e se toca, de olho no chibio da morena. A que zoeira, que festa de aroma. Põe essa galera pra samba, é debaixo da saia.
Yeah.
Okay, we're back, and I'm looking over some quotations from Theodore Roosevelt, and I'm looking for a good one. There are good men and bad men of all nationalities, creeds, and colors. And if this world of ours is ever to become what we hope someday, it may become, it must be by the general recognition that a man's heart and soul, a man's worth and actions determine his standings. It is my good fortune at San Diego to serve beside colored troops. A man who is not good enough, who is good enough to shed his blood for the country, is good enough to be given a square deal afterwards. More than that, no man is entitled to, and less than that, no man shall have. And he gave that speech at the Lincoln Monument in 1903. Let me see if we got another one here. I determined on the move without consulting the cabinet, precisely as I took Panama without consulting the cabinet. A council of war never fights, and in a crisis the duty of a leader is to lead and not to take refuge behind the generally timid wisdom of a multitude of counselors. Oh, he should have read that to Obama before Benghazi, huh? I believe what I did in settling the anthracite coal strike was a matter of very real movement from the standpoint not only of industrial but of social reform and progress. So he must have intervened. Let me see if we got another one here. Presidency. The most successful politician is he who says what everybody is thinking most often and in the loudest voice. It is dreadful misfortune for a man to grow to feel that his whole livelihood and whole happiness depend upon him staying in office. Political parties exist to secure responsible government and to execute the will of the people. From these great tasks, both of the old parties have turned aside. Instead of instruments to promote the general welfare, they have become the tools of corrupt interests, which use them impartially to serve their selfish purposes. Behind the ostensible government sits enthroned an invisible government, owing no allegiance and acknowledging no responsibility to the people. That's what we have today. To destroy the invisible government, to dissolve the unholy alliance between corrupt business and corrupt politics, it is the first task of the statesmanship of the day. The bosses of the Democrat Party and the bosses of the Republican Party alike have a closer grip than ever before on the party machines in the states and the nation. This crooked control of both the old parties by the beneficiaries of political and business privilege renders it hopeless to expect any far-reaching and fundamental service from either. No people who wholly civilized where a distinction is drawn, no people is wholly civilized where a distinction is drawn between stealing an office and stealing a purse. I do not number party loyalty among my commandments. My hat is in the ring, the fight is on, I'm stripped to the buff. A man may neglect his political duties because he is too lazy, too selfish, too short-sighted, or too timid. But whatever the reason may be, it is certainly an unworthy reason, and it shows either a weakness or worse than a weakness in the man's character. In politics, as in life, generally, the strife is well nigh unceasing, and breathing spots are few. Even if the struggle results in a victory, it usually opens the way for another struggle. Good point. The first requisite of a good citizen in this republic of ours is that he shall and be able and willing to pull his weight. There can be no 50-50 Americanism in this country. There is room here for only 100% Americanism, only for those who are American and nothing else. Very good. There can be no divided allegiance here. Any man who says he is an American but something else also isn't an American at all. We have room for but one flag, the American flag. We have room for but one language here, and that is the English language, for we intend to see that the crucible turns our people out as Americans of American nationality and not as dwellers in a polyglot boarding house, and we have room for but one sole loyalty, and that loyalty is to the American people. The man who loves other countries as much as he does his own is quite noxious, a member of society, as the man who loves other women as much as he loves his wife. To love one's country above all is in no way incompatible with respecting and wishing well to others. Our country has been populated by pioneers, and therefore it has more energy, more enterprise, more expansive power than any other in the wide world. Every expansion of a great civilized power means a victory for law, order, and righteousness. Take a break. I give you a tune. And when we come back, we'll read somebody else's book. We'll do a Pepe of Brazil. Oops. Don't tell me we're frozen here. Can't be. There we go. Pepe Brazil.
Quero ver todo mundo na palma da mão.
Madalena que abaixa o carro, Madalena.
povo se estremece de emoção. Giga enlouquece o corpo e a alma, que esse samba é de primeira. E Madalena, oh Madalena, Madalena não quer mais parar de samba. Vamos ver!
Madalena quer batucar, Madalena, Madalena quer sambar.
That peppy? That was pretty peppy, huh? Don't let the language fool you. Most of the songs are about love. When you hear them more, you know it's about love. I got a couple of things Jimmy from Brooklyn sent me. He wants me to know that there's a real communist threat in the United States. It never went away, and when the wall came down, a lot of foolish Republicans thought they had beat the Russians. And now it doesn't look that way. And every day it gets a little sicker. And speaking of sicker, there is a lieutenant named Lawrence who just got 20 years in jail for doing what he thought was the right thing, taking out the two stalkers who were calling in his position to the Taliban. And for that, they appointed a captain to persecute him and make an example of him so nobody else doesn't shoot until they're fired upon. And this is the Obama takedown of the U.S. military. He has relieved 200 combat-experienced officers and admirals of their positions, including one who was in charge of 450 missiles. This man is a dangerous man. He's working behind the scenes. He has seeded, S-E-E-D-E-D, the entire government with quislings who are doing everything in their power to destroy the United States. In my humble opinion, I used to say in my expert opinion. Jimmy sent me an article, a meeting article from the Brecht Forum at West 27th Street in New York. And the Brecht Forum, Jimmy says, is a communist front group. And anybody who's a member is a communist sympathizer. And the title, it's a Friday and Saturday forum in 2002 at NYU, the Tishman Auditorium. And it's a tribute to W.E. Du Bois, or Du Bois. They say Du Bois. I went to a school named after a bishop, and his name was Du Bois. Of the 20th century is the problem of the color line, the relation of the darker races to the lighter races of men and women in Asia and in Africa, in America and the islands of the sea. and they have a partial list of workshops. The Color Line Today, the Post-Durban Global Anti-Racist Movement, Labor, Immigration, and Race, Race Ideology and Media in the 21st Century, Responsibility of White People in the Struggle for Racial Justice, Combating Racial Tensions Among People of Color, Repression and Police Brutality Challenging the Prison Industrial Complex, Resistance to Racism in Popular Culture. And those are the topics. On the occasion of W.E.B. Du Bois' 134th birthday, this conference seeks to bring together progressive activists, that's communists, and analysts, communists, to assess the ways the issue of race and racism has changed in the last 100 years, to look at how racist ideology is ingrained in our culture, and to advance a dialogue on how we can work to solve the problem of the color line in this new century. 100 years ago, W.E.B. Du Bois placed solving the problem of the color line on a historical agenda central to any vision of a just and egalitarian society. Now we find ourselves in the era of global capital, and rather than declining, racism is on the rise, both at home and around the world. The gap between wealth and poverty is growing rather than declining, and the suffering falls in even higher proportions to people of color. At the dawn of the 21st century, new movements are emerging to challenge globalization with a better belief that a world is possible, from the anti-World Bank and IMF struggles that burst into the public eye in 1999 in Seattle, to the World Conference on Racism, despite a U.S. boycott, identifying colonialism and the transatlantic slave trade as crimes against humanity, and the new anti-war movement that is becoming into following the events of September 11th. Yet perhaps Du Bois identified the key a century ago. If you want a broad-based, multifaceted democratic government that could confront cultural, political, and economic offensive of global capitalism, we must place the struggle. So, come and join the Communist Party. Jimmy mentions another organization, the Institute for Policy Studies. He says that's a KGB front group. So he sent me an information bulletin on the 27th Congress of the Communist Party of the Soviet Union. Documents of the Communist and Workers' Party's articles and speeches, and that's dated September 1986. It's the first issue. And he just put a little side note on some of the articles, and he goes, April 22nd is Earth Day, and it's also Lenin's birthday. So we're celebrating communist holidays with phony things like global warming. You see those three icebreakers up there? They can't get through the ice. Unbelievable. Analysis of yet another group of contradictions, those on a global scale, affecting the very foundations of the existence of civilization, leads to serious conclusions. All this crap is being taught in communist universities, you know. In thinking of the future, it may be said that the potentialities for cooperation between the Soviet Union and China are enormous. They are great because such cooperation is in accordance with the interest of both countries, because what is dearest to our peoples, socialism and peace, is indivisible. Yes. And Jimmy has a little note that says, Red China and the Soviets are partners. They let everybody believe they had a split only to get American money. Once they got the American money, they said, we're back. The party committees and organizations and ideological institutions must make full use of the ideological wealth of the party program of the political report of the CPSU Central Committee and of the 27th Party Congress decisions in shaping an integral Marxist-Leninist worldview. The Congress notes that the growing role of the mass and propaganda media in promoting the party's economic strategy, its a social policy, and in cultivating the socialist consciousness. It regards television, radio, and the press as powerful vehicles, and we totally endorse NBC. I'm making that up. The Congress calls on writers and artists to create works that will be worthy of the greatness of the party. You mean like the two atheists that wrote Kumar and Harold and Kumar's Christmas, 3D Christmas? Yeah. They're writing songs for Miley Soros, I call her. Miley Soros. George Soros' daughter. Yeah. He's got a little side note here. Larry Flint. And sex perv or patriot. Yeah. Reds to use media worldwide to denounce America and promote the Soviet Union and elect Obama. That's one of his notes. Sent me this article. This one is the World Marxist Review, September 1989. And problems of peace and socialism. And in this one, our party was created in 1976 in the course of pitch battles for the future of Egypt. The foundations for accord. Abdel Gaffer Shuker, Secretary CC, National Progressive Unionist Party of Egypt. I was shocked. I was talking to a guy one day when we first got into Iraq. And I said, what's the biggest political party there? And he said, the Ba'ath Party. I said, what's the next biggest one? And I think he said it was either the second or the third, the Communist Party. I couldn't believe it. I didn't even think there was a Communist Party in Iraq. So it shows you what I know. So let's see what this says here. The NPUP was formed on a legal basis by a well-known political figure, Khalid Mohieldin, and a group of leaders from the organizational and ideologically distinct Marxist Nazarite, social democrat, pan-Arabic, and progressive religious currents, which emerged in the process of the National Democratic Revolution. And Jimmy has got a little note when it says progressive religious currents. He's got a little note to the outside border. It says liberation theology, Arab Muslim style, of an Antonio Gramsci. Antonio Gramsci is an Italian that wrote How to Break the Catholic Church by Infiltration. In a country with widespread literacy and no democratic traditions, effective struggle requires that the party turn to amass a support base of factory workers, peasants, intellectuals, and students. You know, those are all the people that get executed first in the Soviet Union. Our primary organizations are building their activity on a territorial administrative basis and strengthening their ties with democratic organizations, workers' trade unions, associations of non-manual workers, and peasant, youth, student, and cultural unions. Particular attention is to be paid to the creation of party cells in industry and in public organizations. When the computer first came out, I wanted to look up Chevron. To see what kind of company they were. And when I Googled the Chevron, the first thing that came up was Chevron's union of gay and lesbians. I said, my God, what has this got to do with business? But it came up first, and that's how busy and active they've become. And here's the last page of this article that Jimmy sent me, and he's written on it. All languages, all countries, all coordinated and connected. All languages, all countries, all coordinated and connected. And it says, Problems of Peace and Socialism is also published in Arabic, Amharic, Baluchi, Bengali, Bulgarian, Czech, Danish, Dari, Fazi, Finnish, French, German, Greek, Gujarati, Hebrew, Hindi, Hungarian, Indonesian, Kurdish, Lao, Malayalam, Maltese, Manipuri, Mongolian, Norwegian, Oriya, Pashto, Polish, Portuguese, Punjabi, Romanian, Russian, Sinhalese, Spanish, Tagalog, Tamil, Telugu, Turkish, and Vietnamese. On the editorial board, Council of Members are representatives of the parties of the following countries: Algeria, Argentina, Austria, Belgium, Bolivia, Brazil, Bulgaria, Canada, Chile, Colombia, Costa Rica, Cuba, Cyprus, Czechoslovakia, Denmark, Dominican Republic, Ecuador, Egypt, El Salvador, Finland, France, and Germany, Democratic Republic, Federal Republic of Germany, Great Britain, Greece, Guatemala, Guyana, Honduras, Hungary, India, Indonesia, Iran, Iraq, Ireland, Israel, Jamaica, Japan, Jordan, Democratic People's Republic of Korea, Lebanon, Lesotho, Luxembourg, Mexico, Mongolia, Morocco, Palestine, Panama, Paraguay, Peru, Philippines, Poland, Portugal, Romania, Saudi Arabia, Senegal, South Africa, Soviet Union, Spain, Sri Lanka, Sudan, Sweden, Switzerland, Syria, Turkey, United States, Uruguay, Venezuela, Vietnam, and the People's Republic of Yemen. That's a lot of members, huh? All over the world. You think that we have defeated communism? Then he sent me one from February of 1934. How to penetrate, in March of 1935, how to penetrate Negro organizations. We have some excellent experiences in New York, in Queens. We have been able, just on one issue, and maybe this is the secret of it, to get together over 60 various organizations of the Negro people on the question of discrimination in the hospital in Queens. We have the Alpha Benevolent Association, the American League Against War and Fascism, the Amity Baptist Church, Arawat Democratic Club, Bayside City League, NAACP, etc. About 70 organizations have come together and conducted a struggle in Queens for the right of Negroes in the hospitals in the city of New York. That's in March of 1935. What do you think? What do you think? Do you think that we're being divided so we can be conquered? And here's a speech from the Reverend Bernard Scheel, the Bishop of Chicago, founder and International Director General Catholic Youth Organization, delivered at the UAW-CIO International Education Conference in Chicago, Illinois, and it's an attack on Joe McCarthy. So, and I guess the biggest thing that McCarthy was accused of, he was accusing General Marshall as a traitor. So I just thought I'd give you that. We'll give you another tune. We'll give you a short one. We'll give you Owa Owa. That's also Brazilian.
Owa Owa. Owa Owa.
O seu rosto ainda
next book we're going to refer to is None Dare Call It Treason 25 Years Later. And it's by a guy named John A. Stormer. And on page 17, they're talking about the fake-out of a fainting weakness while overcoming your enemies when the Soviet Union collapsed. What if all the changes are for real? And a guy named, a syndicated columnist named Cal Thomas, put the situation into perspective in January 1992. He wrote, "Before Soviet communism is allowed to sleep gently into the night, a full accounting is required of those who offered it political life support, without which it might have died much more quickly. A non-judicial forum on the scale of the Nuremberg war crimes trial should be held to indict those in the academic, financial, political, artistic, and religious communities past and present who gave aid and comfort to Marxism-Leninism." Thomas detailed how American liberals for decades admired and idealized political systems in highly repressive communist countries, including flagrant human rights abuses, even as they denounced comparatively minor infractions in the United States and other Western nations. Whether it was Nicaragua, El Salvador, Grenada, or Cuba in our hemisphere, or Angola, Afghanistan, Ethiopia, and South America, the script was the same. Whether the communist leader was Mao Zedong or Fidel Castro, Ho Chi Minh or Leonid Brezhnev, he could do no wrong. Many liberals saw these leaders as near gods and the freedom fighters who opposed them as repressive louts. To those on the left, communists were liberating heroes who had the best plan for the transformation of mankind and society. The list of apologists, their fellow travelers, and dupes is book length. Every editorial writer, every author, every artist, and every university professor who defended the horror of communism should be brought to the People's Court of Public Opinion. Those who wrote and spoke in favor of communism should be given a chance to recant or lose not their rights, but whatever credibility remains. Thomas was very correctly concluded, saying, "This is the only way history and the future can be fairly served. By remembering and judging those who betrayed the truth, we help preserve and protect and defend coming generations from making similar mistakes." And I'm jumping over to another page because something reached out and grabbed me. It says, "Know your enemy." That's the first thing they teach you when you go into the service. When you go into the halls and in the barracks, they got pictures up of what the Soviet troops look like, how to recognize their ranks on their markings, what outfits they're from. Know your enemy, because communism is alive and well in many areas of the world, and communists could still be working deceptively in what was the Soviet Union and Eastern Europe. It is vital to understand how they work. That understanding is essential because the supposed reforms under Perestroika and Glasnost and Yeltsin's Commonwealth of Republics could be an implementation of Leninist teaching that to advance you must know how to make strategic retreats. Lenin taught that progress toward the ultimate goal of communism is made through the dialectic process of one step forward and two steps back. Chinese communist theorists use the term three steps forward and two steps back. Dr. Fred Schwartz, in his classic work, You Can Trust the Communists to Be Communist, described communist dialectical progress, which proceeds in a deceptive way and pattern. Dr. Schwartz said that communists never move directly towards their ultimate goal, he explained. The dialectic pathway to progress is different. It consists of a resolute forward advance followed by an abrupt turn and retreat. Having retreated a distance, there is another turn in advance through a series of forward-backward steps the goal is approached. To advance thus is to advance dialectically. The communist goal is fixed and changeless, and their direction of advance reverses itself from time to time. They approach their goal by going directly away from the considerable portion of the time. If we judge where the communists are going by the direction in which they are moving, we will obviously be deceived. So, this is what we got. And we've got a government that's riddled with communists and liars and Benghazi, a troop abandoning. And I've always said Democrats get you into war and they leave you to die on the battlefield. And they've done it again. They did it in Nam. They got us into Nam. They left us to die on the battlefield. They got us into Libya. There was no reason to be there. And they left us to die on the battlefield. And now we've got 65,000 American troops. And minus one who has been given 20 years in prison for shooting at the Taliban. Okay, on a patrol, protecting his men. He was being stalked by two Taliban observers who were calling in coordinates to the Taliban. They were unarmed, but they were armed with a telephone. And you know how much damage you can do with a telephone. You can set off an IED with a telephone. You can betray a person on the telephone. You can order the death of somebody on the telephone. Those two guys were taken out, and this lieutenant was tried with murder. Probably his prosecuting attorney, it's my guess, had no combat experience. But how quick he must have been eager to make an example out of that lieutenant, because he's in part of the Brownie Point division. And I'd like to know who else he has prosecuted vigorously and what their sentences were. So say a little prayer that Lieutenant Lawrence gets justice. And I got to tell you, when you're up against military justice, you're not getting justice. You got to lawyer up with civilian lawyers, otherwise you're screwed. And they intimidate you by forcing you to plead guilty. They will tell you, if you oppose us, you will get a longer sentence. If you plead guilty, we will give you a shorter sentence. Now, is that the justice? Is that the American way? No, it's not. But it is the order of the day. And this president has the blood of 65,000 Americans on his hands if he screws up the evacuation of Afghanistan. And based on his Obamacare fiasco, I put very little faith in his ability to evacuate 65,000 troops. He couldn't get four out of Benghazi. And every jihadi and his mother is coming in for the kill. So, they will come from all over the world. So, in closing, I will give you somebody sent me, one of those scroll-down pictures, and it says, would you like to see the first king-size bed? And I scroll down. You know what it was? It was a manger.
was bright with a holy light for the place where Jesus lay. Hallelujah, oh how the angels sang. Hallelujah, how it rang. And the sky was bright with a holy light. Was the birthday of a king. Twas a humble birthplace, but oh, how much God gave to us that day. From the manger bed, what a path has led, what a perfect holy way. Hallelujah. Was the first